We'll just get started here. First, we do the preliminary homage, paying respect to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So that's at the top of your document. You could just say it yourself, or not if you prefer. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Mundhang Bhagavantang Abhivading Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namah Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Okay, welcome everyone to our first look at the Satipatthana Sutta. Try to go slowly through it, so hopefully it can be meditative in some way. The Satipatthana Sutta is the classic text on Buddhist meditation. As always, I'm by no means qualified to give you the full and complete explanation of this sutta, but I'm all you got, so I'm going to try to go through it and try to keep it simple. I apologize in advance for forgetting things and misquoting things and being vague and so on and so on. But the Satipatthana Sutta is a good one because, first of all, it's, as I said, the classic meditation text. And also because it's, as a meditation text, it's very simple, very easy to understand. There's a few parts that might cause trouble, but for the most part, it's quite straightforward. And there are many things that can be expanded on in the sutta, so it is kind of fun to, or nice sutta to discuss. Another great thing about it is we have a really wonderful commentary on the internet, which I'm going to be using for this study session. If you want to go there, you're welcome to follow along at that, the Access to Insight page, which is the Way of Mindfulness by Soma Thera, which is just a translation of the sutta, the translation that we're using, and then a translation of both the commentary and the sub-commentary, or pieces of that translation. So the first part of the sutta is just the standard introduction, where the Buddha was when he gave this discourse. And if you read through the commentary, there's some interesting points to note. Actually, not very interesting, but there are some points about the place, why it's called what it's called, why the people are called what they are called. You can read over that yourself if you're interested. But one thing that's interesting is the Buddha said, or the commentary says, that the reason the Buddha gave this discourse in the land of the Kurus is because it was a perfect environment. The weather was good, never too hot, never too cold, and food was readily available. And so as a result, it was very easy and very suitable for the practice of mindfulness meditation. And it said that everyone in the, all of the Buddhists in this part of India would practice mindful satipatthana meditation as a part of their daily lives, and they would ask each other, what satipatthana are you practicing today? And if they said, today I'm practicing this satipatthana or that satipatthana, or today I'm practicing all four satipatthanas, and they would say, good for you, you haven't wasted your life. But if they said, today I haven't had time, then they would admonish each other and say, you were born, here you are born a human, but you're as though already dead, and you've wasted the time, you're wasting the opportunity that you have to be alive in the time of the Buddha. The point, I mean, this is a story that the commentary gives, but the point is that the point they're trying to make is that it was an ideal meditation location. I think if you go to India, you'll probably still find that. It's supposed to be in the area of New Delhi, which is, I think, a fairly nice place to live. I've never been to New Delhi, but that is the capital, I think. It's where the Taj Mahal is. And then he starts the discourse. We get right into the discourse. So it's brief introduction is where he was, and the fact that he was living near the market town. And this is actually a mistranslation, because according to the commentary, he wasn't living in the Kurus, or he wasn't living at Kamasadhamma. He was living near Kamasadhamma, because there was no place to stay in Kamasadhamma, but he was living in a park near there. Anyway, that's the introduction. And then he starts the discourse. He addresses the bhikkhus and says that, gives this famous proclamation. Ekayano ayang bhikkhave maggo sattanang visuddhiya soka paridevana samatikamaya dukkha domanasanang athangamaya nyayasa adhikamaya nibbanasa sacchikiriyaya yadidang chattaro satipatthana. So we're not going to get very far. I'm not going to try to plow through this, and probably we won't take 2 hours each session. So I'd like to focus on this statement, actually, for some time. We'll get through this paragraph today. I'm not sure how much further we'll get. See how long it takes us. But there's a lot in here. This one paragraph is probably one of the, well, in my mind anyway, one of the most important paragraphs in the Tipitaka. Yeah, I mean, there's many, but this is one of the important ones. And the translation here is, this is the only way, which is subject to some controversy, only in the West, only because people hate to hear this phrase, this is the only way, because actually it's pretty obvious that, as many teachers have pointed out, you can't really reach Nibbana without practicing mindfulness. If you're forgetful, you'll never get there. It's not possible. It's only with the development of mindfulness, in whatever way. The point is, there are many ways that you can develop mindfulness, of course. But unmindful people can't reach Nibbana. It's just not possible. So for the Buddha to say this is the only way isn't really a very bold statement. it's clear and useful. That helps us to understand that how important mindfulness is, but it's not saying anything radical. It's just saying if you're not paying attention, you'll never see the truth. Right? If you don't look at something, how can you possibly see it? And in this case, it's something that's very difficult to see. So it takes a lot of development. Then you have this idea of the only way elsewhere. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, what does he say? Anyone know this one? Natanyo, eseva mango natanyo, dasanasa visuddhiya. This indeed is the path, there are no others. Natanyo, no others exist. And that's in regards actually to the Eightfold Noble Path. The Buddha says in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta that the Eightfold Noble Path is the requirement. If a religion has the Eightfold Noble Path, then that religion can be said to have Sotapanna, Sakitagami, Anagami, and Arahant. But a religion without the Eightfold Noble Path will have no possibility for the existence of the four types of Arya Pugala. And so in a way, the path of mindfulness is just a short form of the Eightfold Noble Path. It's pointing to the one factor that we consciously develop in meditation. And it's likened to a car. If you want to start a car, you only have to turn the key and then all the different parts of the car start moving. You don't have to go around turning on each and every one of them. And Ajahn Tong gives the simile and explains in quite some detail how the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhamma all come into play based on the practice of the four Satipatthana. Because in fact they do. This is just a practical way of explaining the Eightfold Noble Path. So everybody get comfortable. Let's remind ourselves again that this is supposed to be an immersive course where we're actually being we're actually trying to be mindful. Here I'm getting distracted. So first we want to, discuss this phrase, this is the only way. Because actually it has several meanings, four or five meanings actually, I think. This is the only way. So let's, give me a second here. So we have this only way. I'm going to give five definitions of this only way. Five different find this. Here we are. Okay, the only way. Means it is a single road? No. It means a single way, so there is only one way, this one. It doesn't fork direct way, not forking. It is a personal way. Must be traveled It is the way of the one. It leads to one thing. So these are the five different definitions of the only way, and I put it as a comment on the original documents, which may be working now. I don't know if the chat there is working yet, but the document page seems to be working fine now. Yeah, okay, I think we can go back to the document page chat. No need to use the Sri Mangala chat. So the word only doesn't have to mean. The word here is ekayano, and so this word, we had a debate some time back, and there's probably many debates about this word, whether it actually does mean the only way. Eka means one. Ayana means going, let's say. So if you wanted to be strict about the translation, you would say, this path is the one going path. Or some people have said the one way path. But that idiom in English doesn't seem to be quite the idiom in Pali. It's difficult to say. There is a debate as to what this means, as I said, by people who don't like the idea of the only way. And as I said, it's not that big of a deal. Anyway, just so you know, that word is a little bit controversial as to what it means. Here we have a question. The Vajrayana practitioners say that tantric practices can also lead to enlightenment. Does that view conflict with this line of the sutta? Well, that's a pretty difficult question. Obviously, Vajrayana has generally a somewhat different intent. I assume the intent there is to become Buddha. Or to become a permanent bodhisattva or whatever the Vajrayana goal is, it's very difficult to talk about in terms of this sutta, because we're dealing with a fairly specific philosophy and doctrine and understanding of what Buddhism is. There are many, many different ideas of what Buddhism is, even within what we call the Theravada, or what people call the Theravada. So they might call themselves Theravada, but have a very different idea of what enlightenment means. So when you say can also lead to enlightenment, tantric practices themselves can't lead directly to enlightenment in terms of my understanding of what enlightenment is, and in terms of what the Theravada tradition understands enlightenment to be. Now, if you're mindful of your Vajrayana practice, then you actually can go to enlightenment. If you're mindful of ultimate reality in whatever way that is, in any way that may exist, then you can reach enlightenment. If you read the Visuddhimagga, you'll see how this goes, how they understand it. In the Visuddhimagga, of course, there are 40 different meditation objects, and that's only if you're interested in practicing samatha first. Then if you want to practice vipassana directly, then there's even one other way. And 40 is actually just a general idea. You can imagine that there may be an unlimited number of meditation objects possible. If any of you have seen my video on meditation for kids, I gave them a cat as their meditation object, because it seems true that it really 40 is just a... Actually, the 40 are could be the best or among the best. Obviously, a cat is substandard in compared to the Buddha, for example. But if you read the Visuddhimagga, you'll see that after talking about these meditations and explaining how to practice them, then the text is very careful in each instance to explain how then, using that practice, you can go on to develop mindfulness and become aware and remind yourself of the reality of this. The reality behind the object. So what in the case of Anapanasati, if you're developing the jhanas first, then you actually don't use Anapanasati to become enlightened. You use the jhana factors, the bliss, and you focus on the bliss or the calm or the one-pointedness, and you look at it and you see it as being impermanent, unsatisfying, and non-self. And if you're practicing just vipassana, then you look at the breath as being made up of the four satipatthanas. There's the physical element of the vayodhatu in the abdomen, rising and falling. There's the vedana, the happy feeling or the peaceful feeling or the unpleasant feeling. There's the knowledge of it, which is the mind. And then there's the feelings about it, liking, the thoughts about it, liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and so on. So you see it in terms of the physical and mental realities that make up the breath body. But the point being, either way, you have to eventually come back to mindfulness. Mindfulness is the only way. So the word bhikkhu here is another interesting word. Because in this sutta, it actually may not be referring to the monks. It may be directly referring to the monks, but one thing that you'll often hear meditation teachers say is that we shouldn't be discouraged by the fact that the Buddha is using the word bhikkhu, because bhikkhu actually comes from, it can be derived in two ways. Bhikkhati, bhikkhatiti bhikkhu is the simple way. He begs, and therefore he's a bhikkhu. But see, the funny thing is that monks don't beg, right? Buddhist monks are not allowed to practice begging. So this couldn't be the meaning of the word bhikkhu. So the commentaries give an alternative. I think the Buddha maybe even gives an alternative definition. And that is saṃsāre bhāyaṃ ikatīti. Ikatīti. Bhikkhu. Saṃsā. Is that a long A? Yes, a second. Yeah, it's a long A. Saṃsāre bhāyaṃ ikatīti. Bhāyaṃ ikatīti. So what this means, one who sees ikati, the fearsomeness or the danger, bhaya, in saṃsāra, is called a bhikkhu. So rest assured that all of you here could be considered bhikkhus because of your intention to practice meditation, which is based on your ability to see the dangers in just wandering on or letting yourself go with the flow of your following your heart, you know, following your desires, following your likes and dislikes, letting yourself stay untrained, the danger in this. And so you come here to train your mind. This makes you a bhikkhu. Another way of understanding this is that we consider there are two kinds of bhikkhu: a vinaya bhikkhu and a sutta bhikkhu. The vinaya bhikkhu is the monk who takes on the life of a renunciant and takes vows of poverty and chastity and simplicity. So we have rules and so on, or a code that a bhikkhu takes. But a sutta bhikkhu is this other definition, saṃsāre bhāyaṃ ikatīti, anyone who sees the danger in saṃsāra, which means the danger in wandering aimlessly and letting yourself follow after your heart's desires. Of course, the danger is that you get lost and mixed up and make mistakes and cause suffering for yourself and others, do bad things, say bad things, think bad things, and so on. That you suffer as a result. So, here we are going word by word. Then we have what are considered to be the five benefits of the practice of satipatthana. And I guess it's not the intent here to go into great detail about these. But one thing that you might, that many people may not have ever noticed, is that if you've ever seen these videos I did on the top five reasons for practicing meditation. In fact, when we were giving out DVDs, I actually made it into a second DVD on why practice meditation and the top five reasons. I was actually being sneaky because it's actually these five reasons, five purposes for the practice of satipatthana. The first one is that Satipatthana practice leads to purification. The second is that it leads to overcoming sorrow and lamentation. The third, well, or any kind of mental illness is the word I use, but we're using that word, of course, very lightly, very loosely. Any kind of dis-ease or discomfort in mental turmoil. But you could say mental disease, mental sickness, because we can consider in a way that depression and so on are mental sicknesses. For the destruction of suffering and grief. Now, this is not a good translation. The word, well, actually, it is kind of direct, isn't it? Suffering here, he's translating the word dukkha. But if you know anything about Buddhist terminology, when you pair dukkha up with domanasa, if we look here, dukkha domanasa nang. Dukkha and domanasa, when you put them together, you can't translate dukkha as just suffering, because domanasa is suffering as well. But dukkha is referring, in when it's paired in this way, dukkha refers to bodily suffering, domanasa refers to mental suffering. That's how the pair works, because both of them are dukkha. But it comes down to an understanding of the Abhidhamma. If you read the Abhidhamma, you understand that there are actually five types of feeling. In the Abhidhamma we have Sukha Vedana and Somanasa Vedana, which is bodily pleasant feeling and mental pleasant feeling. And then we have Dukkha and Domanasa, Dukkha Vedana, Domanasa Vedana. Or I think it's called Dukkha Kaya Vedana, no, Dukkha Vedana. Dukkha is unpleasant bodily feeling, Domanasa is unpleasant mental feeling. So we're overcoming physical and mental suffering for attaining the right path. And for attaining the goal, which is Nibbana. And the commentary says something interesting, points out the fact that it's actually kind of redundant to talk about all these things. If you're talking purely in terms of what Satipatthana leads to, you don't need to get past the first purpose. It's not necessary to mention all five, because once your mind is pure, all the other four follow. Or not all other four, the second, third, fourth, and fifth, are presupposed by the first one. If your mind is pure, it's because of the other five. No, the other four. And the commentary says something interesting. It explains this. It says, obviously, this is a means of teaching. This is a teaching tool. And we've talked about this before in the other suttas, that the Buddha will often repeat the same word in different ways. So in the first sutta we have jnana udapadi, aloko udapadi, vidya udapadi, knowledge arose, wisdom arose, light arose, and it's just saying the same thing over and over again. But it's a means of impressing upon the listener the nature of what you're talking about. A good example is how we practice meditation. When we say to ourselves, for example, you feel the pain and you say pain, you're really doing the same thing to yourself. You're impressing upon the mind the nature of the meditation object, reminding yourself, bringing your mind closer to the object. This works as well in teaching, repeating the same things again and again. So as the Buddha would be explaining this, and if you read through in the next paragraph, it's all repetition, right? First he says, kaya kaya nupasi viharati atapi sampajano satima Vinaya loke abhijja domanasang. And then he doesn't have to say that for each one. He could say kaya vedana jitta dhamma, and then say the rest of it. But instead he repeats the same thing four times. The sentence is repeated, and just substituting kaya vedana jitta dhamma. And that's really an important part of the teaching, because he wouldn't just be saying this quickly. He would be giving it to them as a meditation, so saying first we're mindful of the body, and then letting it be known what aspects, well, when we get to that paragraph we'll talk about that, but what aspects are required to be mindful, and giving it to them as a meditation practice, then going on to Vedana, saying now we focus on Vedana, and then, or you can focus on Vedana or Jitta or Dhamma, and so at the same time they would be reminded of their own physical and mental experiences. They'd become aware of their bodies and become mindful of them. They become mindful of their feelings, mindful of the mind, mindful of their emotions, and so on. So in regards to giving five purposes here, it sounds a lot more impressive. And the point that the commentary makes is that actually the point is most people don't realize this, and they can't extrapolate. They hear the first one, and the commentary doesn't say this, but actually if you think about it, the first one is not that appealing to most people. The first one is actually a negative thing. It's that you have to give something up. You have to do some cleaning. You have to do some work. And by itself, it's of no benefit, right? Purity isn't a good thing, right? It isn't intrinsically beneficial. You think, well, if you're pure or impure, that's not the point. But the point is what purity leads to. If your mind is impure, that's not a bad thing in itself, but it's a horrible thing because of what it inevitably leads to. Purity is an excellent thing. It's the most important thing, but only because of the benefits that it brings. Purity by itself, not very attractive to most people. It's like the fact that cleaning your house isn't that attractive. For most people, the idea of cleaning their house is actually fairly repulsive. But we do it for a purpose, because we know that it's actually a wonderful thing to clean your house, not because of the effort put out in cleaning, but because of the benefits that come from having a clean house. And so it's because most people, or one of the reasons is obviously because most people don't understand this, that if you just say this is for the purification of beings, it's not that attractive. But by expanding on that and saying, well, if you have purity of mind, then you overcome sorrow and lamentation. You overcome any kind of mental sickness, depression, mourning, stress, neurosis. You can overcome all sorts of mental diseases through the practice of meditation. Mental upset. The total destruction of suffering, of bodily suffering and mental suffering, attaining the right path, and attaining nibbana actually is. Well, we'll get to it. Let's go in one by one. So the first one here is the purification of beings, and I've put a quote. I don't know where it went. The quote disappeared. Were we all looking at the right text? My quote disappeared. Must be a Google thing. Anyway, I put a quote that was actually the commentary quotes the Samyutta Nikaya by saying that one is purified because of one's mental purity. Citta sankile sa bhikkhave satta. Citta sankile sa bhikkhave satta sankili santi. Beings are defiled due to the defilement of the mind. Citta vodana satta visujanti. So Sanyutta 22:100. The Dutiya Gadula Baddha Sutta. So with the purification of the mind, a being is purified. Because there is no purification of the body. The practice of the Buddha's teaching is not for the purification of the body. It's not possible. Because the body eventually breaks down, falls apart, and undergoes change. The purification of the mind is possible. So what this means is that one's stream of consciousness can be cleansed of any impurity, so that every mind that arises in succession is a pure mind. It's based on the attainment of wisdom and the realization of Nibbana. Specifically, it means the purification of the mind from three things, which most of you are probably aware of. This is the three akusala mulani, the three roots of all unwholesomeness, which is greed, anger, and delusion. So it's the purification of the mind from these things. And this is a important point to remember as meditators, what we're striving for and how we can judge our practice. When people wonder where they are in their practice and whether they're progressing in their practice, they should look and consider in themselves in regards to these three things, whether they still have greed, still have anger, still have delusion. And to the extent that these have been removed from the mind, to that extent one can be considered to have progressed. One can consider that they are progressing. To the extent that they're still existing in the mind, to that extent one can consider there is still work to be done. Number two, overcoming sorrow and lamentation. Here the standard thing to do here is to tell a bunch of stories, which I guess I should do, because this is what the commentary does. And this is where if you've ever had a teacher who teaches based on the Satipatthana Sutta, you'll often, a traditional teacher, you'll often hear them give some stories. And there are these stories which are associated with the practice of Satipatthana. It's because they're in the commentary. The first one is this minister Santati. And his story is that he was given... He was a minister to a certain king. Can't remember which one, probably Pasenadi or something. And he went off and quelled a border uprising, which means there was someone who was causing trouble, trying to take over the kingdom. And so he went and probably killed a bunch of people, probably did some bad stuff. Anyway, he ended the trouble for the king, and so the king gave them this reward to be to have the same level of enjoyment and opulence as the king for 7 days. So he was to live like a king for 7 days as his reward. And so he lived for those 7 days in kind of in a drunken stupor. He was drunk and surrounded by women and opulence and so on. And he had this dancer, who his favorite dancer, who he had dance for him and do this Indian dancing. And so for 7 days he amused himself in various ways. And sometime, probably on the seventh day or whatever, this woman, this dancer, because she was starving herself in order to look thin, which I guess was the was his preference, and she died while she was dancing. She had a stroke or something due to lack of proper nutrition. And he got so distressed, this minister Santati got so distressed that he went to see the Buddha and asked the Buddha what to do about it. It's an interesting story, specifically because he was drunk, right? And actually, from listening to the Buddha's teaching, the story goes that he became enlightened. So why it's an interesting story because of that is that it means drunk people can actually sober up and become enlightened. You can also imagine that it's something to do with the Buddha and the Buddha's purification. But it is true that, you know, there is to a certain extent anyway, the possibility to overcome the drunken state, because alcohol is just a physical thing. No, it doesn't actually dirty the mind, so it is technically possible. I'm not sure how in practice how possible it is, but it's technically possible for the mind to be mindful during the time that one is drunk, or to become mindful and become mindful of the drunken state or whatever. And he may not have been totally drunk, he may have just been tipsy. But the Buddha taught him, purge out the things belonging to the past, let there be naught in the world to rise in future times. If what's twixt past and future you don't grasp, you will be one who wanders forth serene. And he became an arahant hearing this stanza. The next story is the story of Patachara. Patachara, we'll get to her in the Dhammapada if we ever do any more Dhammapada videos. But it is in the Dhammapada. Am I wrong about that? Maybe it's not in the Dhammapada. May not be. It's in the Tarikatha, I guess. Can't remember. Anyway, the story goes that she... she married a man who her parents didn't want her to marry. It's the same story as... Chulapantaka, which we'll get to, which is the next story that we're waiting for. She married a servant, and then she had to run away and elope with him because her parents would have been terribly upset. And they lived alone in the forest, and then she got pregnant and wanted to go home. Her husband forbid her, and she left on her own. Husband caught up with her. She gave birth on the path, and they went back home. Got pregnant again, wanted to go home. Husband forbid her. She went on her own. Husband caught up with her. This time there was a big storm, so they couldn't go back. She gave birth there. Her husband went off to find some firewood or some shelter or something, got bitten by a snake. And it is in the Dhammapada because I've translated this before. Bitten by a snake, killed instantly, and Patachara is there with her two children. Rain goes away, storm ends, she goes off to find her husband, finds out he's dead, starts getting upset, but decides that she'd better continue on and go home to her parents. Gets close to the village, finds that the river next to the village, or the town where she lived, has flooded and is quite difficult to cross. So she puts the older child, one who can walk, on one side and starts to cross with the baby, crosses to the other side with the baby, puts it down on the far shore, comes back across the river to get her bigger child. On the way back across the river to get the older child, a hawk or an eagle swoops down and picks up her baby, thinking it to be a piece of meat. She gets frantic and starts to wave at the bird, trying to scare it away. the older son thinks she's calling to him, jumps in the river to come to her, and gets carried away by the current. Both sons die. Now she's quite upset. And so nothing left to do. Her mind is getting a little bit unhitched at this point, and she goes back to try to find her parents, asks around for her parents, or goes to her parents' house or something, or just asks about them and finds out that they've all died in a fire the night before during the storm. House was hit by lightning or whatever, there was a fire, and they all died. So in one day she lost her entire family, husband, two children, parents, and all relatives. And she goes crazy. She tears off her clothes, wanders around mad, totally unhitched. Unhinged? That's the word. Unhinged. Unhinged. And people start calling her, oh, mad Patachara. They call her the crazy Patachara. And this is in Jetavana, or this is in Savatthi. So she comes wandering into Jetavana where the Buddha is giving a teaching, and she wanders right into where the Buddha is teaching. And the monks are ready to chase her away, and all the lay people who are listening want to chase her away, and the Buddha says, no, no, let her come. And then he says to her, he gives this famous verse, which the commentary doesn't mention, and it's that, oh, Patachara, it's true, you have lost your entire family in one day. But he said, the tears that you have cried, I got it wrong, the oceans, in the water in the four oceans, no, the tears that you have cried, for loss of parents, loss of children, loss of husband, loss of wife, in all the rounds of samsara, are greater, far greater than the oceans, than the waters in the four oceans. All the water in all the oceans of the world, much greater than the tears that you have shed. That's a lot of tears. But it's an important point, and the Buddha shocks her with this, and she becomes mindful again and decides to become a bhikkhuni. Becomes a bhikkhuni and then becomes enlightened. So the point is that both of these people were able to overcome sorrow and lamentation, overcome their despair, their mental upset. This point, the important thing is to separate this from the next one, which actually is a much simpler way of talking about what we're talking about here. But Soka Parideva is more like the manifestations of suffering. And so that's why I like to explain it as mental disease or mental sickness or so on. That comes from suffering, comes from dislike, comes from the upset, comes from stress. And they were able to do this with mindfulness, with remembering themselves and coming back to the present. Santati, the idea is that he practiced. He was told to forget about the past and the future, so he was able to see what was happening in the present and not grasp at it. But Patachara, she was likewise able to practice the four satipatthana and overcome her distress. So that's the second. The third is the ability to overcome physical suffering and mental suffering. Mental suffering is easier to understand here. See, it actually goes in the other order, because you have to overcome mental suffering first and then physical suffering, or you have to destroy mental suffering first. The word he uses here is destruction, atangamaya. And you can't destroy physical suffering as long as you have a body, right? So to be free from physical suffering, you first have to get rid of mental suffering. And the steps go as follows. First you get rid of mental suffering, and at which point you still have physical suffering, but you've overcome it. You don't feel it to be stressful or to be suffering. And then through the practice and the attainment of of Arahant, you become totally free from physical suffering as well. But it's an important point here to separate the two out. Because the only problem with physical suffering is that it tends to lead to mental suffering. If it didn't tend to lead to mental suffering, there'd be nothing wrong with it. If we didn't give rise to mental suffering based on the physical pain that arises, it would be of no consequence to us. And the good example that they give is of the elder Tissa, who was very rich and gave away all his wealth when he heard the Buddha's teaching that we don't take anything with us. All of the wealth, all of the luxury, all of the good things that we have in this life, none of them follow us. Even our relatives can't follow us any further than the graveyard. And so he decided to become a monk and give away all his wealth. He gave it to his younger brother. His younger brother had a wife, and this wife was of the jealous sort of person. And she convinced? I can't remember. She took it upon herself to have the older brother killed, thinking, what if he comes back and wants, what if he gives up the monk's life and wants his treasure, but wants his money back, wants his wealth back? So she thought, best thing is to get rid of him, bump him off, and then we won't have anything to worry about. The treasure will always be ours. No, we'll never have to give up our wealth. We'll never be at that risk. So she hired a band of 500, which just really means a large number of mercenaries, to scour the forest to find him. So he was off meditating in the forest, and they found him. And they surrounded him, and he said, "Lay disciples, why have you come?" And he said, "To kill you." They say, "To kill you." And the elder said, "On the security, give me my life for just this one night." So he was a hardcore meditator, right? He wasn't even concerned. He was like dead set on becoming enlightened. So he said, "If you're going to kill me, come back tomorrow morning. I'm not finished meditating yet." They said, "How you, if we leave you alone, you'll run away." And he said, "Let me. I'll give you a security, a surety. What do you call that when you deposit something?
Collateral.
That's the word." And they say, "What sort of collateral can you give us?" And so he took a big stone and he broke both of his legs. This is how the story goes. And he says, "How's that for collateral?" Or he says, "Lay disciples, is this security of value?" And they just shook their heads and walked away, because now he wasn't going to go anywhere. So they went to the end of the ambulatory and, lighting a fire, lay on the ground. Now they had nothing to worry about. They said, "Okay." I mean, basically, must have been overwhelmed by the fact that he had just broken both his legs. And they're like, "I guess we can give him one night." Yeah. And the elder, contemplating on the purity of his conduct, after suppressing the pain, attained arahantship at dawn. And he gave expression to his feelings. A surety let me raise, breaking both my legs. To die with lustful mind, I loathe and shrink. Having thought thus, I saw things as they are. And with the dawn, I reached the arahant's domain. Good story to remember when you have pain in meditation. Nothing compared to Tissa's pain. So if you can't deal with your pain, well, consider the importance of pain as a meditation subject. Consider how strong his mind must have been to be able to do that and to be mindful of it. A good example is, right now I have a cut in my foot, and I'm not sure if there's still a piece of glass in there, but there's probably still a piece of glass in the foot. And I was thinking about this today while I was jabbing it with a sharp scissor. I don't have a scalpel, but I was jabbing it and trying to find the piece of glass. And then there was one point where there was so much pain, and I was trying to pry what I thought was a piece of glass out of it. I don't know if it was or not. And the pain just became excruciating. But as soon as you say to yourself, pain, pain, you realize it's actually harmless. This incredible, excruciating, like mind-numbing pain just becomes nothing. It becomes as though a trifle. And I was able to tear my foot apart. Still didn't get the piece of glass, but did end up tearing my foot apart a little bit. So the idea here is that physical and mental pain are two very different things, and in fact, physical pain is not even painful if you're mindful of it. It's actually just a pressure, and this is an amazing thing for a meditator when they first experience this, that what they thought was pain is actually not painful, and the pain is all in the mind. Because when you say to yourself, and if you're mindful and clear in the mind, when you say to yourself, pain, pain, and your mind becomes free from the hindrances, you find that all the pain that you were experiencing disappears in an instant. When you're not mindful, it comes back, and then when you're mindful again, it goes away, and you say, there's something here. So that's how you get rid of mental suffering, and as a result, really get rid of physical suffering, even here and now. But actual physical suffering, of course, can only be gotten rid of through the attainment of arahantship and ultimate parinibbana. But for the time being, it's just as though there were no suffering, because it's not experienced as suffering. It's not experienced with any unpleasantness whatsoever when the mind is pure. Commentary gives some other stories. I'm not going to go into them. We'll stay there. The next one is Nyayasa Adhikamaya, for attaining the right path. So what we're talking about here, and the commentary gives some explanation and discussion about this, is the Satipatthana path, and this is an important point to note. When we talk about ekayano, a young mango, when we talk about the manga that we're following, the path, it's actually the preliminary paths, the pubanga manga. Let me put that note in. When we talk about manga here, the only way because you can see this preliminary path leads to the Aryamanga. This manga leads to the Aryamanga. Atanga Nyayasa Adhikamaya. And we have a question. So, you mean you don't feel the pain anymore, you feel it, but in a different way. You feel physical pain. See, according to the Abhidhamma, it's in a different category. There's no domanasa. There's no mental suffering. You actually just experience it as tension, as pressure or hardness or whatever. When you're truly mindful, you experience it as a totally neutral experience. The sharpness is gone. The painfulness of it is gone. For that moment, of course, it comes back when you get upset about it again. But at the moment when you're mindful, and for an arahant, of course, it's all neutral, it's all ordinary. They never experience a painful sensation in the sense, this is painful. They just know it to be a sensation.
Wouldn't that be the, how it always says, in and of itself, because then it's not in relation to anything else. It's not pain being compared to a pleasant sensation. It's just pain being compared to itself. Just pain. So, you know, it's pain. So then it's just sensation.
Yeah, but the sharpness is, the sharpness is gone. The painfulness is gone. See, because Vedana is a mental, is considered to be a mental aggregate. In the suttas anyway, no? So, according to the suttas, the dukkha Vedana is actually mental, and that is gone. So the Abhidhamma is just giving a technical addition there of a physical sort of pain, but it's not painful. It's not, and you can, when you practice meditation, when you're deep into it, you notice the pain disappears, right? Well, the sensation is still there. The body didn't change, right? But it's no longer painful. There's no longer a judgment of it. So it's no longer painful. Okay, so the Eightfold Noble Path again is this moment where the mind enters into Nibbana. The first realization, the first moment where one realizes Nibbana is called the Eightfold Noble Path. Because at that moment, one has acquired all eight of these factors, and they are at their culmination. And one experiences the mind which cuts off the defilements. This is the mind which takes Nibbana as the object for the first time. And that is called the path because it is the that which leads to the extinction of the defilements. It's not actually how we would think of a path, right? Because at that moment it's actually realization of Nibbana. It should be considered the fruit. But that first moment of the fruit is called the path because it's the moment that technically can never be followed with certain defilements. Certain defilements are cut off after that moment. And it's only a technical definition, really. But that moment occurs as a result of practicing Satipatthana. Therefore, Satipatthana is called the way to realize the way. Way to realize the nyaya, the path, or that which should be attained. The fifth one is Nibbana Satchikiriyaya. And I think we've been through this word Satchikiriyaya. In fact, I'm quite sure that we have sa. Achi kiri kiriya make known as if with one's own eyes. Something like this. So sa means with, achi is aki, it comes from I, from aki, which means I, and kiriya to make. So to make known as if seen with one's own eyes. Kind of an important derivation to know, because that's the word attainment is. Well, it's hard to find a better translation, no, but it actually means much more than that. For the seeing Nibbana for oneself would be probably a better translation. And in some places it actually means something. It's realizing the truth for oneself or so on. But of course, I guess it's quite obvious that Nibbana is something that has to be seen for oneself. If you're going to realize Nibbana, it's not going to come from intellectual activity, although some people might misunderstand that if the Buddha didn't say Nibbana sa sacchikiriyaya, that Nibbana has to be realized for oneself. People might think that through reading this discourse and thinking about the Buddha's teaching, you can come to appreciate the practice of satipatthana and giving up the lobha, dosa, moha, greed, anger, and delusion. And then you think, wow, then I must now be realizing Nibbana, or I must now have attained the goal, which is to understand. But then you see this and you say, well, I haven't seen for myself something called Nibbana. So unless you misunderstand Nibbana, you know that you haven't realized the goal yet. The last thing the commentary says here is that, in this regard, is that actually Sattanang Visuddhiya is the final outcome. First one has to realize Nibbana. When one realizes Nibbana, as I said, that first moment of realizing Nibbana is the path. And that is what overcomes, or that is what destroys Dukkha Domanasa, because it is the cessation of suffering. Actually, at that moment, since there's no experience of physical or mental phenomena, therefore there's neither Dukkha nor Domanasa, there's neither physical pain nor mental pain. So that's what it means. Nibbana is the destruction. That's why Nibbana is called the cessation of suffering, because there can be no experience of either Dukkha or Domanasa. Since there's no Dukkha and Domanasa, then there's also no sorrow, lamentation, despair, and so on. And because there's no despairing over things, or however, because of the purity, as a result of seeing Nibbana, when one comes out of Nibbana and is, or the cessation ends, there is the arising, no, what I mean, there is further arising of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. The mind is pure. The mind is purer than it was before. Thanks. I know it's off subject, but actually I wrap my foot in coconut and sugar, because coconut oil and sugar are supposed to magically pull the sliver out to the top. So I'm going to believe in this magic and see what happens tomorrow morning. This one's got to be karmic, because I've gotten glass in my foot many times and it never sticks in like this. Okay, so to end the suspense, what is this only way that leads to these five things? It is the four satipatthana. That should have been painfully obvious already. But for the people hearing this, this would be the first, it's making an impression. It's saying, this is the only way to these five things, and suddenly it's got their attention. What is it? What is it? What is this thing that's leading to all these wonderful, wonderful things? And then the Buddha says, the four satipatthana. So now he's got their attention. Now they're like, ooh, teach us these four satipatthana, because sounds good. And the commentary asks a question as to why there are four satipatthana and not five or three or so on. This is a good question. It's one of those questions you get often. Why are there seven? Why is everything seven or so on? We always get this question. In India, everything is seven. In whatever Indian religion you come across, it's always seven this, seven that. And you have, why do you have four noble truths? Why do you have four foundations of mindfulness? Why this? Why that? So, but this is a good question, especially because you already have the five aggregates. And dukkha satcha is the five aggregates. You're supposed to, as we saw in the first sutta, it's the five aggregates that you're supposed to know clearly. No. So why is the Buddha introducing something new when actually he's just repeating himself? The five aggregates are another way of, or the four satipatthana are just another way of talking about the five aggregates. And the commentary proposes several reasons. Two main reasons. The first one is because it accords with the character types of people who practice vipassana. So we give a note here on the word four. A whole bunch of notes. Four character types. Character classes. Raga, and also passionate, but how do we say, what's a good way to say dumb? Weak wisdom, I think is the word. Passionate, strong wisdom. And intellectual, weak wisdom. Opinionated, strong wisdom. Okay, this is the first classification. A person who is passionate should practice either kaya nupassana, mindfulness of the body, or vedana nupassana, mindfulness of feelings. So a person with weak wisdom, this can be a very young person, or it could be a very old person whose mind is not so clear, or just a person who is not very spiritual, you might say. Someone who is fairly material, a coarse individual, someone without profound thoughts or spiritual thoughts, should practice mindfulness of the body. A passionate person, if they're a passionate sort. If they're opinionated, they should practice mindfulness of the mind and mindfulness of the Dhamma. If someone is passionate with strong wisdom, practice Vedana. If someone is opinionated, but with the Pali words are raga and ditti. Raga, someone who is a passionate sort, and opinionated means someone who has views. Ditti charita. So another classification, or more. Is that the first satipatthana is for people who practice samatha, who have practiced samatha meditation with weak wisdom. Vedana nupassana, this is pretty detailed, I know, but let's consider this to be something you can reference later and think about and stuff. And cittanupassana for a person who is a vipassana jnanika with weak wisdom. And dhammanupassana is for a vipassana jnanika with strong wisdom. That's the second way. The third way, the third reason for having four of them is for the four vipalasa. Let's make sure I'm spelling that right. Two L's, one S. Illusions or perversions, I thought, but I may be wrong. One, beauty. Two, happiness. Three, permanence. Four, self. So the four illusions, and this is an important, this is a teaching of the Buddha. It's a very important teaching, and it relates, this is probably the best reason, because it relates directly to these four. So the commentary says, for the purpose of overcoming these four illusions, the Buddha has taught the four foundations of mindfulness. So beauty is in regards to the body. We think very much that the body is beautiful, or maybe our body is ugly, and we wish it were beautiful. We think this, that, oh, my body is beautiful, or oh, my body is ugly. Or we think, oh, that person's body is ugly, or that person's body is beautiful. And try to attain physical beauty so we can see beautiful things all the time. So we become attached to the body in this way. So mindfulness of the body helps us to overcome this. You find that the body is actually not as beautiful and wonderful as we originally thought. You're able to let go of this illusion of beauty. And we'll see as we go through the body that many of the practices the Buddha recommends here really do that, help to overcome this idea that the body is something beautiful. We have an attachment to happiness, right? This belief that happy feelings are happiness. And so the commentary says right away, the body is not beautiful. And the feelings are suffering. It says right away, it says, kind of harsh of the commentary. It makes you think that commentaries are not the best thing for just anyone to read, because they might get the wrong idea. But I don't think so. It's a very important wake-up call for us. See, the commentary says the body is ugly. Just comes out and says it. There are people led astray by the illusion that it is a thing of beauty. Feeling is suffering because, well, we've gone over this. No, unpleasant feelings are intrinsically suffering. They're called dukkha. Neutral feelings are called sankhara dukkha, because you have to work to maintain them. Any kind of stability or calm or peace has to be maintained. And pleasant feelings are viparinama dukkha, because when we cling to them and we like them, then we suffer when they're gone. We suffer because of their change. So when we're mindful of the feelings, we come to see this, and we see that actually happiness has nothing to do with feelings whatsoever. Feelings are impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable. And so the third illusion is the idea of permanence. We think that we are a permanent entity. There's the I that continues on, the soul in the body, you know, which is the mind. So practicing mindfulness of the mind, we come to see what the commentary says, that consciousness is impermanent. when they see the consciousness arising and ceasing and arising based on an object and ceasing and so on, then they'll give up this idea of permanence. Dhamma. Dhamma really means states, no? Or phenomena. Really everything are insubstantial or not self, contain no entity. No entity. So because of, you might say because of the hindrances, because of the aggregates, because of the senses, when it comes together and we think I am this and this is who I am, and this idea of an entity or a being, when everything comes together. So when all the emotions come together, we think, oh, I'm this sort of person with these sort of emotions. When the aggregates come together, we think, I am this person with this body and this mind. When the senses come together, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, you think that this is a person, this is a being, this experience, because it puts like the illusion of like this, we're talking about pointillist, no? Where you put these points on paper and it turns into a picture, but actually if you look up close, it's just points. So when you put all this together, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, if you're not practicing meditation, it seems to be a being. When you practice meditation, you can find that even the body disappears, you find that the mind arises and ceases quickly and so on. And so you do away with this belief in a self. It's an important teaching. It's one that we have to keep in mind and understand, because that's the purpose of practicing Satipatthana. How does it fit in to wish for peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering, happiness being an illusion? Happiness isn't an illusion. Happiness in feelings is an illusion. Finding happiness, thinking of feelings as being happy. Or the sukha vipalasa means the idea of finding sukha in some experience. We talked about this before, I think, because the idea of happiness, or the truth of happiness, is actually a slippery thing. It is generally referred to as, in a negative sense, as being the freedom from suffering. It's very difficult to talk about, and it's the subject of a lot of doubt among Buddhist practitioners. There was a monk in the Buddhist time who asked Sariputta, he said, if there's no Vedana in Nibbana, the experience of Nibbana is devoid of Vedana, how can it be happiness? And Sariputta said, it's exactly because there is no Vedana in the experience of Nibbana, and that Nibbana is considered to be the highest happiness. This really sums it up quite clearly, what we're talking about. The feelings are dukkha. All feelings are considered to be dukkha. So only without them can one be said to enter into true happiness. So the illusion of happiness is that there is a state or an experience that is, can be considered happiness, can be called happiness. In a conventional sense, it is considered happiness. A happy feeling is considered happiness. But in an ultimate sense, we know that it's not true. In practice meditation, you see that, and even just by experience in the world, you can see that these happy feelings have not made you happier overall. They only make you more attached, more, you only make you want more of them. So this is the reason for teaching for Satipatthana, Kaya Vedana Jitta Dhamma. And with this we haven't finished the introduction as it is in the Sutta, but we finished the first three paragraphs, first two paragraphs. The first sentence that the Buddha gave, we finished it. We finished one sentence. Good for us. Okay, so we're going to quit there and come back next week. Thanks everyone for showing up. Looks like it's shaping up to be a good group. I'll have to set up a bunch of backups for all the technical difficulties we're having so I can redirect people if something goes wrong. Yeah, I mean, you might say, if you want to be hard about it or harsh about it, you might say that the idea of happiness is an illusion. Happiness, the idea that there is happiness is an illusion, and all you can hope for is freedom from suffering. But I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha was often talking about how that freedom from suffering is happiness. And you have to see it as happiness. The reason, or the answer is to practice, and the answer is to realize it for yourself, to see that any doubt you might have or any qualms you might have about this idea are just your own, due to your own attachment to feelings, to pleasant feelings. When you give that up, you'll be much happier. And when you realize Nibbana, you will have happiness that is incomparable. There's nothing that could possibly compare to it. So any kind of doubt that you might have had before will disappear by itself with the attainment of Nibbana. There's no question. At that moment, there is a bliss that is impossible to beat, impossible to compare. And the resulting peace that enters into your life as a consequence, leaves you with no doubt, not a shred of doubt about what is real happiness. Would you recommend cultivating the four foundations of mindfulness separately in meditation? Well, I don't. No, I teach all four of them. And so you see there's this the commentary says, different character types should practice different satipatthanas. It's not really true, and doesn't really seem to be the Buddha's intention in the sutta. And the commentary kind of waffles on it. The commentary is not saying anything hard and fast by that. It's just, and it even mentions this, it says it's just telling you which should be focused on, because everyone will have to practice all four, and all four are applicable. But a person who is of a certain character type should focus on, or will have to focus on one of the four, or will spend more time focusing on one of the four than they will on the other. But even the commentary is clear that all four of them should be practiced.
How would you focus on one or the other?
Well, you could ignore stuff, no? Like when you're thinking, you just say, no, that's not my satipatthana, and you focus only on vedana, for example. But it you see how it doesn't make much sense, because they're going to all come up, and you focus on whichever is clearest, right? I'm going to say something else and I forgot. Is there danger to practicing mindfulness of death and contemplation on foulness, possibly leading to hatred or aversion towards the body? Yeah, indeed, there is. No, I don't know. It depends. See, there's a story that goes like that, that there were these guys who practiced mindfulness of the body, loathsomeness of the body, and became so disgusted they wanted to kill themselves. But it's kind of absurd, because how could one lead to the other? When you actually practice loathsomeness of the body, your mind becomes calm, your mind becomes focused. But the Buddha gave them this because he saw that they were going to kill themselves anyway, and he wanted to give them something that would at least lead them to be born in a good way. So when he gave this to them, all of these feelings that they had inside came up. as a result of the concentration, as a result of the focus in the mind, and they did kill them. They killed each other, or they killed themselves, or had someone kill them. And as a result, but as a result of their practice, they were actually born in a good way, or something like that. It's actually an interesting story. I'm not sure the veracity of it, but no, it shouldn't lead to any aversion towards the body if practiced correctly. The problem is that it may be difficult for a person of hating temperament to practice it correctly, to actually develop concentration, because instead they will, as you say, give rise to more anger and more hatred. So this is the danger in samatha practice in general, that you have to know what your character type is and which is appropriate. If you read the Visuddhimagga, it talks about 6 different character types and which are appropriate for which character type. Mindfulness of death may not be appropriate. It would only be appropriate for a certain type of individual. The kasinas, for instance, I think are appropriate for anyone. Anapanasati is appropriate for anyone, this kind of thing. But certain ones are only appropriate for certain people. So mindfulness of death you use when you are negligent, for a person who has lots of delusion. No, he didn't tell them that. What happened is after they died, Ananda came up and said, Lord Buddha, the Buddha went into seclusion when this happened. And when he came out, he said, Lord Buddha, they killed themselves. And he said, please, can we have a better meditation, like a more softer meditation practice? Because I guess Ananda seemed to think that it was because of the meditation practice. But the commentary says it wasn't because of the meditation practice. It was because of they had been hunters in past lives. They'd been a group of hunters, and so they had killed lots of beings, and as a result they were going to die. But the Buddha said, well, practice anapanasati. Because anapanasati is what is the word? Asejanakoja. I forget all that. There's many, many good qualities of anapanasati. Mindfulness of breathing. When I teach Satipatthana, of course, we only focus on the bare essence of the sutta. We're not going to talk about all these different Kayanupassana practices because they don't quite fit with the overall nature of the sutta. In fact, they seem to have kind of been tacked on. But I don't think it's too much to suggest that the Buddha tacked them on himself. Some people say, oh, these are just monks putting everything in the pot, so combining everything together to make a sutta. But you have to remember that the Buddha is talking to a group of people and he wants to give them a lot of different tools, no? So at times he'll remind them of mindfulness of loathsomeness and mindfulness of the cemetery contemplations, of mindfulness of death, and so on, to wake them up and to give them some, put some spice in it, no? But we should be clear what is the essence of the sutta, and that is simple mindfulness of the body. So when the stomach rises, knowing the stomach rises. When you're walking, know that you're walking. When you're sitting, know that you're sitting, and so on. And the rest of the sutta is quite clear in this. It's only really kaya nupasana that is unclear, that seems to be have many different parts to it. But vedana nupasana, citta nupasana, dhamma nupasana is all very clear, that it's just mindfulness of the states as they arise. Kaya nupasana just has a whole bunch of stuff in it that can be useful and has a lot to do with the protective meditations. Can you tell us something of your experience of craving and suffering as a monk as opposed to when you're a layperson? Well, that's going to have to wait till tomorrow, I think, because that's an Ask the Monk question. Not that quite has to do with the sutta at hand. So I'm going to leave it there. Let's go back up to the top. And if you have questions, You're welcome to bring them to the radio at radio.sirimangalo.org, which is tomorrow at the same time. I'll go back, scroll back up to the top, and do the preliminary homage one more time. Arahang samma sambuddho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivadin svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammang namasa subhatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang nama. And that's our study session for today.